Acne remains a condition that requires the full cooperation of the patient to follow the instructions given by their dermatologist. Despite proper treatment, this condition may lead to scarring and potential damage to the psyche of our patients. In our last dialogue, Dr. Murad Alam and Dr. Mary Martini discuss acne scarring and its current treatment.
I'd like to welcome Dr. Murad Alam today. He will be speaking on the treatment of acne scarring. Dr. Alam is coming from Chicago. He is professor of dermatology at Northwestern University and head of dermatologic surgery in the Department of Dermatology. Welcome, Murad.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just get to it, and let me ask you the first question. Why is treating acne scarring important?
Well, acne scarring is something that can make a lifelong difference in people's lives. From a young age, they have acne, and then gradually it culminates into different sorts of disfigurement on their cheeks, their face, what they initially present to other people, and this can make them a little more withdrawn, socially aware, anxious, and can interchange the interactions and their perception of what they look like. So it's really something that we want to deal with if at all we can.
What are the types of acne scars?
There are different classifications for acne scars. A number of people have implemented different classification schemes, but perhaps one of the best known is in a paper by Kaminer et al. From earlier this millennium. And the paper classifies acne scars into four categories: rolling scars, ice pick scars, boxcar scars, both shallow boxcar and deep boxcar. And really this refers to the type of contour. So ice pick scars, as you can imagine, are deep penetrating scars that have a point in the base but go quite deep into the dermis. And rolling scars are gently undulating scars that don't have a particular base or top, but look more like a ripple, hills and valleys. Boxcar scars are similar to ice pick scars, but a little different in that rather than having a single point at the base, they have a flat surface at the base. So they look almost like an indented square, but they can be deeper or shallower.
What is the best age at which patients should seek treatment for acne scarring?
There's no perfect age for seeking treatment, but in general, we suggest that at a point when the patient is an adult and they're self-conscious about their acne scars and perhaps most of their active acne is under control, that's a good point to do this at because we obviously want them to benefit from the treatment of the acne scar and the improvement in the appearance for the longest time possible. So why wait?
So if you have an anxious mother who wants her daughter scarring treated, what would you advise the mother?
I think it's good to treat acne scars early, but you wouldn't want to do it very, very early. For instance, an early adolescence might be too early because we still don't know the course of their active acne, and we really want to make sure that's under control. Also, as you know, in some cases, very extreme acne scarring is treated with isotretinoin, and we really don't want to do any significant manipulation of the acne scars for at least a year after that.
Okay. What are the best treatments for acne scarring?
There's a lot of controversy about what the best treatments are, and I think the best answer to this question is there's several treatments that can be combined to give an optimal benefit. So these treatments address the acne scar from different points. There are treatments that can go underneath the skin to release fibrous bands and create some reactive fibrosis to raise depressed scars. There are treatments that can excise the most flagrant, deepest kind of acne scars that other modalities can't treat. And then there are laser procedures for the surface that can smoothen, coming from the top, sand down the skin, so to speak, into the mid-dermis and let it re-epithelialize, hopefully with less scarring.
Do acne scars ever need to be cut out?
Yes, sometimes they do, and there are certain kinds that are amenable to cutting out. For instance, if somebody has a very, very deep grooved scar, you can do a linear excision and remove it in its entirety. Some very deep ice pick scars, you just can't get to the base of them. So what do you do? You could do a punch float, where you do something analogous to a punch biopsy around the scar, but you don't take the tissue out. You just let it float up to the skin and then fasten it to the surrounding skin once it gets to the right level using either glue or a single stitch.
And what sort of laser resurfacing treatments are appropriate?
Laser resurfacing is probably the last element of treatment of acne scars. Once you've cut out what you need to, once you've raised what you need to, then you might go and do a laser treatment. And just to go back, one other treatment treatment you can consider is something called subcision, where you go underneath the skin and you release the fibrous bands by using a sharp implement at the dermal subcutaneous junction. That can cause a little bit of bleeding, help cause some reactive fibrosis and raise the scar. So once you're done with that, once you've cut out what, if anything, you need to cut out, then you do a little bit of superficial sanding with a laser. And there are different kinds of lasers that you can use, which we can discuss in greater detail, but the purpose is to hide the acne scars and also to hide any scars from excisional procedures you might have done to make the acne scars go away.
So ice pick scars you may often treat with punch excision. Right. A rolling scar, how is that often treated?
Good question. Rolling scars are fortunately not that hard to treat, but require different modalities. And subcision, I think, is one of the optimal methods for that. And that what we do in subcision is we numb up the entire area, we let anesthesia sit for a while, and then we insert typically a no-core needle, which has a spear-like tip, but various other types of needles have been used as well. And you move it back and forth underneath the skin in a crisscross motion, similar to liposuction, but you're not pulling anything out, you're just advancing the needle. And by doing that, you abrade the underside of the dermis, and you kind of get the scar to raise up, and the hills and valleys to become relatively more flat. Some people feel you also get a little bit of bleeding, which then granulates and organizes into a clot that also helps to push the scar up.
And post-op wound care for that treatment, are they bandaged?
They can be. They usually just need band-aids. You get a little bit of bruising, and the way to avoid that is to let the anesthesia sit in for a long time before doing this. But usually it's just bruising. In fact, the post-op care is so minimal that this is a good procedure for patients with skin of color, because since it doesn't entail cutting the surface or lasering the surface of the skin, the risks of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, which are a problem with skin of color patients, are much diminished.
So if we're looking at boxcar scarring, what is your modality that you use most frequently?
I think laser resurfacing is definitely one. And if they're shallow boxcar scars, that may in fact be sufficient. If they're deeper boxcar scars, cutting out in some manner might be necessary, because you simply can't get that deep with lasers. You don't want to get into the reticular dermis with a laser, lest you completely ablate all the follicular structures and get a resulting scar. So I think it depends what kind of boxcar scars. And also there are different kinds of laser treatments that you can use. So for instance, if you have relatively shallower scars, you might consider non-ablative resurfacing, which means a number of treatments with brief downtime using a laser that isn't a carbon dioxide laser, like a 1550 nanometer laser or many others. But if the scars are deeper and you feel that such a gentler treatment wouldn't work, then you can try something like carbon dioxide resurfacing, which has maybe 1 to 2 week downtime. All resurfacing at this point is usually fractional, so it's not the traditional kind where you remove all the skin. You remove little bits of skin, but how deeply you drill down those holes varies depending on what kind of laser you use.
Is ablative resurfacing more effective than non-ablative?
That's a good question, and no one really knows for sure. There are a few papers now that have tried to compare the two, and I think if you speak to people anecdotally, they do feel that there's a benefit to carbon dioxide resurfacing. But the question really is, how many carbon dioxide treatments are equal to one non-carbon dioxide treatment, or vice versa? And that conversion factor hasn't been well described. But I think there is a feeling in the community that carbon dioxide isn't that much more effective than non-ablative resurfacing. So it's not as if one CO2 treatment is equal to 6 non-ablative treatments. And so it often becomes a matter of what's best for the patient. Do they want just 1 or 2 treatments with long downtime after each treatment, or do they want a number of treatments, 5 or 6, with just 2 days downtime after each treatment? And sometimes I think actually people go for the second option, and I think often you can get very good results with that.
Is skin of color an option in considering the laser?
Very much so. You can do resurfacing with skin of color, but you're usually confined to doing non-ablative or partially ablative rather than fully ablative with CO2. And the reason, again, is hyperpigmentation. If you use a carbon dioxide laser, even a so-called gentler fractional laser on a patient with skin of color, it's virtual certainty you're going to get hyperpigmentation, and that might take a year or longer to resolve. So there are very few cases in which you'd do that. But non-ablative, you can do in patients with type 4, 5, even 6 skin.
What about chemical peels and dermabrasion? What is their role in therapy?
It's a matter of preference. All of these modalities, laser resurfacing, chemical peels, and dermabrasion, have the same general effect in terms of sanding down the skin and causing re-epithelialization at the level of the papillary dermis. Which procedure you like is often just a factor of what you're most comfortable doing and what you were trained to do. So dermabrasion, unfortunately, while it's a good procedure, is less performed now, at least within dermatology, because it's no longer really taught in residency programs. Chemical peels, similar. Dermabrasion is mechanical abrasion. Chemical peels are obviously chemical abrasion. So-called medium-depth chemical peels with 35% trichloroacetic acid are comparable to laser resurfacing, and it's a matter of preference. There's some benefits. The chemical peels do not require an expensive laser and maintenance of such and so forth. They might not go quite as deep either, some trade-offs. And of course, they require training in chemical peels, which is more of an operator-dependent procedure. Unlike the laser, which will fire the same energy every time you press the button, here you do have to have a little bit more skill involved. Not that laser doesn't require skill, but specialized training to make sure you get an appropriate depth.
What methods can be used to raise depressed or bound down scars?
We discussed subcision a little bit before, but I think that's the same method that you would use for raising rolling scars. And that's one method that's non-excisional, where you go underneath and you kind of move your needle back and forth to free up scars that are bound down. Another method would be the punch flow technique, where the scar isn't coming up, it's too deep to excise, but you use a punch around it without removing the entire tissue cone, but let the tissue cone float upwards by separating it from the dermis. And the residual connection is really in the subcutis, and it can move a little bit more.
So the punch float, do you ever take skin from another part of the face or neck and use it on the face?
You could do that. That would entail a graft, basically. So in the punch float, you're leaving the same plug in the same place. You're just raising it up and gluing it down or suturing it down. But sometimes that tissue might be so damaged you don't want it to remain there. And then you'd literally do a punch biopsy. You'd make a little cylindrical hole in the skin, and then you could acquire a skin graft from somewhere else, perhaps post-auricular, pre-auricular, wherever you deemed there to be a good color and texture match, and then implant it back in the area where you had removed the skin.
Do the new class of skin tightening devices work for acne scars?
I think to some extent they do. And the new class of skin tightening devices, as you know, include infrared devices, so-called 1100 to 1800 nanometer light, perhaps, as well as radiofrequency devices, monopolar, bipolar, unipolar, and ultrasound devices. So those are the three main categories: light, radiofrequency, ultrasound. And collectively, what they do is they heat up the deep dermis, perhaps even some of the fibrous septae, maybe even a little bit of the SMAS. And by causing this deep tissue heating, they cause deep tissue contraction, which also results in some superficial skin tightening. Now, patients with acne scars are seldom those that have sagging skin that requires tightening, but to the extent that smoothening the scar also occurs from tightening, it can be a useful modality, and we have found a significant benefit.
Is there a certain type of patient you use that on?
I think, again, skin of color patients are ideal for this treatment. I think all kinds of patients can benefit probably equally, but it makes special sense in skin of color because the so-called non-ablative skin tightening devices are quote-unquote colorblind. They don't cause any epidermal damage that's significant beyond mild erythema, so they shouldn't cause any hyperpigmentation.
So what do you tell your patients when they develop post-inflammatory pigmentation? How do you treat the discoloration?
I think it's a mixture of hand-holding and time to treat the discoloration. The reality is that once you get PIH, it's going to resolve when it resolves. But just doing nothing for 1 or 2 years is often not acceptable to the patient, and they feel that they might be neglected by you, or they might get increasingly anxious without some interaction with the physician. So some mild techniques can be helpful. For instance, light glycolic or salicylic acid peels, a mixture of topical hydroquinone with a mild steroid to mitigate maybe a little bit of the pigmentation while avoiding an inflammatory response that might result in further hyperpigmentation. And so we would often recommend that patients would come back on a monthly or bimonthly basis until they felt some increased confidence, and we noticed both hopefully by these measures, but certainly based on time alone, that the hyperpigmentation was resolving.
Do you ever use fillers for acne scarring patients?
You can use fillers for acne scarring patients. Rolling scars respond particularly well to fillers because the reason why filler utility might be limited in a deep ice pick scar or a deep boxcar scar is you might inject the filler, but the scar is so well formed, you merely raise it on a hill, but the contour of the scar remains the same. But the hills and valleys are what fillers form, and so rolling scars, which are comprised of hills and valleys, are particularly amenable to treatment. Basically, you find a valley and you inject that, and thereby you blend the two hills and the valley into one uniform platform.
So if you had a rolling scar and you did subcision first, let it heal, then go back, see whatever valleys you have and fill them?
Yes, in fact, that's a good time to do it, because when you do subcision, you create a little pocket inside the skin, a virtual space, if you will. And a month after subcision, the swelling from that procedure has gone down, but there's still a little bit of an opening, which makes it an ideal place to inject filler.
Great. And do you have certain fillers that you use in different areas of the face?
I think all of the temporary prepackaged injectable fillers are useful, including the hyaluronic acids and calcium hydroxylapatite. Probably we don't use so much poly-L-lactate because that's not a linear filler. When you're filling an acne scar, you don't want the whole area to fill. You want a specific place to fill. So you'd use a linear filler, either hyaluronic or calcium hydroxylapatite. The benefit of the latter is it lasts a little bit longer. And one thing you can do is you can inject a little bit into the scar, and you can even press around so you flatten it out. So you can almost over-inject and then kind of squeeze out the remainder to get a perfect contour.
So when a patient comes in and has a mixture of ice pick and rolling scars and maybe even some box scars, are you telling her this treatment's going to involve multiple months, several treatments over a year? What do you tell her to expect?
I try to be realistic, and I've learned this from people who I've seen treated perhaps by others who've had very good results but have been very disappointed because they didn't understand what they should expect. So you have to be very clear. What I recommend to patients is it's going to take at least a year, maybe longer. The first step we have to do is make sure their active acne is completely under control before we even embark on treatment of acne scars. Otherwise, we're really just chasing our tail. And once that's the point that we've reached, then it's going to be multimodal. So there might be something like subcision to free up the deep scars. There might be some excisional procedures. There might be a number of non-ablative laser resurfacing treatments, and these will happen at approximately 1 month intervals. Maybe fillers will be in there as well. And cumulatively, using all of these treatments, if all goes well, I suggest they might get a 40 to 50% improvement in their scarring.
And then is it something they stop back yearly to see you?
I think the good thing about acne scarring is, minus certain procedures like fillers, which do diminish over time, a lot of these provide a permanent benefit. So I think it's good for them to stay in contact with their dermatologist to make sure they're not getting any more active acne and maybe occasionally getting a touch-up procedure. But to a large extent, once they're treated, they're happy. We might not see them for many years.
What new and emerging therapies are on the horizon?
There are a number of potential injectables. For instance, as you know, we already have autologous fibroblasts, where you get a little biopsy from behind your ear. We send this off to a lab that makes your own fibroblasts in culture. You get them back and you can inject them. And that's useful as a fine line filler. It's primarily for cosmetic indications. But to the extent that acne scars are a form of fine line or depressed line, similar methods might be of utility because these are also your cells. They might last longer than a typical filler, and they might persist for a duration. Similarly, there are other stem cell therapies that are underway as well. Stem cells have been useful for wound healing in other parts of the body. And to the extent that acne scar is a form of wound, or it could be de-epithelialized to look more like a wound, similar treatments might be of utility.
So would you punch out the scar, or would you do subcision and then inject the fibroblasts?
I don't think it necessarily matters at what point you do this. I suspect you should probably do whatever else you were planning on doing before doing this. But for instance, when it's used for nasolabial fine lines, which was its initial approval, you don't have to have any preparation. You just inject it directly into those lines.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you'd like to add on the subject?
In my opinion, it's very useful to let people know that acne scarring can be treated. There are a lot of patients who suffer from the psychological impact of acne scars, who've learned to live with them. But in the last few years, the methods we have to address these really have improved quite dramatically. And while it's nowhere near a magic eraser, I think we can give people who have acne scars significant relief in ways that are very, very safe, tolerable, and affordable as they're spread out over some period of time.
If you see an individual that's taking Retin-A and using Retin-A regularly and comes in to see you for acne scarring, do you stop the Retin-A, or how long does she need to wait after you've stopped it for you to treat her acne scars?
Yeah, Retin-A I don't usually put in the same category as isotretinoin, so I'm not too worried. If we're doing a laser resurfacing procedure, we might stop the Retin-A a couple of weeks before that just to avoid an excessively deep laser treatment. But I'm not worried that a manipulation like excision or punching would cause excessive scarring because of the Retin-A on board. That being said, to continue with that question, if I felt the patient had some active acne even if they weren't on oral acne medications like an oral antibiotic, I would strongly suggest they go on to one. And the reason why we do that is because if you are manipulating patients' scars at various levels of the dermis and subcutis, and they have some pretty well-controlled dormant acne, you're actually going to bring it out by doing that. So what we don't want in the middle of acne scar treatment is to get a huge acne flare. So we'd rather just put them on an oral antibiotic for the whole year, even if they're just getting a few pimples, not to be a permanent measure, but just so during the treatment phase, they don't get a breakout.
And if you have a patient that has keloidal scarring elsewhere on the body, does that make you hesitate in terms of therapeutics?
Absolutely. And keloidal scarring is always worrisome. And as you know, it's unpredictable where they might get some more. And especially if they're getting some on their body, you certainly don't want to give them additional keloidal scarring on their face. Now, in some cases, patients who are presenting with that sort of diathesis already have some very bad facial scars. They might be patients of skin of color or just patients who make very, very bad scars from their acne as well. And that's a cautionary note. That would probably reduce your enthusiasm for cutting and incisional procedures, and even for laser resurfacing. You might be relegated more to using subcision, fillers, and other gentle treatments like non-ablative skin tightening devices.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Alam, for coming today, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you.
While many different acne scarring classification systems exist, Dr. Alam referenced one of the best known developed by Kaminer and his colleagues in 2001. This acne scar classification system divides scars into three basic types: 1, ice pick, 2, rolling, and 3, boxcar, which can be further subdivided into shallow or deep. Ice pick scars are typically narrow, less than 2 millimeters, with a wide surface opening such that the epithelial tract extends vertically to the deep dermis or subcutaneous tissue. Rolling scars are a bit wider than ice pick scars, 4 to 5 millimeters, undulating in appearance to the overlying skin. Finally, boxcar scars can look similar to varicella scars in that they may be round to oval depressions with well-demarcated vertical edges. These can be shallow, 0.1 to 0.5 millimeters, or deep, greater than 0.5 millimeters, but are most often 1.5 to 4.0 millimeters in diameter. The guiding principle of this classification system is that each scar subtype has unique physical features that contribute towards determining appropriate therapeutic treatment options. Different modalities exist for treating various types of acne scars. Non-surgical methods include subcutaneous or dermal fillers, including hyaluronic acid, synthetic, and autologous agents. Topical approaches include chemical peels, glycolic acid, trichloroacetic acid, or phenol, as well as microdermabrasion. Surgical techniques include primary elliptical excision, punch elevation, punch grafting, dermal planing, subcision, dermabrasion, and laser skin resurfacing. Ice pick scars with deep bases and narrow, less than 3 millimeter deep boxcar scars are treated with punch excision, whereas wider, greater than 3 millimeter deep boxcar scars can be treated with punch excision or elevation. Shallow boxcar scars are treated best with laser resurfacing, and rolling scars are preferentially treated with subcision, a technique known to free tethering fibrous bands via a tri-beveled hypodermic needle. Combining subcision with other scar revision procedures is often beneficial. However, an amalgamation of approaches is utilized for most types of scars. Laser devices include non-ablative and ablative treatments. Non-ablative lasers selectively damage the dermal tissue while sparing the epidermis and are associated with less downtime and side effects. While ablative skin resurfacing with the CO2 laser was once the gold standard for acne scars, the advent of non-ablative fractional devices has increased in popularity with its ability to offer comparable results with a more rapid recovery, albeit extended treatment sessions. Additionally, these devices are strongly preferred for patients with Fitzpatrick skin types 5 to 6, as CO2 laser resurfacing is associated with a high risk for pigmentary and scarring complications in patients with skin of color. The microsecond pulsed 1064 nanometer ND YAG laser typically offers the lowest risk of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation in this patient population. Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, unfortunately, is a side effect that can occur in up to 40% of cases involving darker skin types following treatment with fractional non-ablative laser resurfacing. A couple of key strategies are useful in maximizing laser treatment outcomes and minimizing the risk for this potential complication. First, lower energies and/or treatment densities and fewer passes per treatment session and an increased total number of treatments should be maintained. Application of topical bleaching creams before and after laser resurfacing and ongoing sun protection during treatment are also beneficial measures. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we'll discuss a whole slew of connective tissue diseases, including cutaneous lupus and dermatomyositis, sarcoidosis, and sclerosing skin conditions. Remember, we now have a presence on Facebook and would like you to join us online for previews, info, and fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. It's important to love and understand the skin. So stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your expertise and your commitment to your patients is appreciated by your community. Have another great month.